Welcome to another edition of Betting People. Thanks very much for all of your kind comments on my interviews with Steve Palmer, Maddie Playle, and of course, Racing Welfare's Dawn Goodfellow. I've got another guest who I'm very excited to bring in today. He is well known to, I'm pretty sure, nearly everybody watching here. It's Simon Rowlands, who is well known for his work at Sky Sports Racing and also in the past with Timeform and the Irish Field. How are you, Simon?
I'm okay, thank you, William. And you? Yeah.
I'm doing very well here, indeed. Looking forward, one hopes with crossed fingers, to the resumption of racing soon in France. But I don't want to jinx that any more than I have to. So to jump right in, you've been in racing for a very long time. How initially did you actually get into the sport?
That's a polite way of saying I'm rather old, isn't it, William? Yeah. How did I get into the sport? I'm not from a racing background whatsoever. Nobody in my immediate family was keen on horse racing or went horse racing. But my dad did have once a year bets on the Grand National. And he used to back several horses in the race and then materialised the ticket with the horse that finished, sneaked into third or fourth place each way, and claimed to have, had it off big time, but which I realise is a very early education in after timing, really. So I was intrigued by this. It was an intriguing, mysterious adult world. It was a very spectacular world, the Grand National and other racing with lots of colours and things going on. And I got increasingly interested in trying to figure out what it was all about. I was particularly interested in the numbers in the days when race cards used to be published in national newspapers and in evening papers. And I kind of figured out that the horses with lots of ones next to their name were better than the ones with zeros, but not always, and who the good jockeys were and everything. Watched those early Grand Nationals. Red Rum, when I was 10, won his first Grand National, and I wrote about it in my junior school diary the following day in a very, very precocious, early, but rather incompetent attempt at racing journalism. One of the watershed moments, though, was the following year when my parents, not knowing what to buy me for my birthday, bought me a form book, a thing called Hague Racehorses, which was became Superform, and which was written by somebody who had been at Timeform. And it was a little potted annual with commentaries about the horses and ratings. And I figured out that the horses with the big ratings were better than the ones with the small ratings. And I had a light bulb moment. That kind of thing didn't happen in things like football. You had tables to tell you that Leeds United were better than Chelsea. It shows how long ago that was. Things like that. But horse racing had this way of saying that horse A was 10 better than horse B. And I was absolutely hooked. Pretty much from that point on in my teen years, I quickly started reading things like Timeform, trying to run my own handicap, doing time figures and the like. And by the end of my teens, I was just desperate to get into horse racing analysis and journalism. And I think over the years, I've realized that the data aspect of things is really what grips me more than anything. But I still like the love the spectacle, love the odd day out of the race course. Have had shares in horses, one of which actually won, and you know that was a lifetime ambition realised.
Wonderful. Guessing with your early and precocious handicapping, you had a fair bit of success when you started out with your betting. Can you remember your first? What's your first big betting memory?
It certainly wasn't a big bet. I think it was 50p each way. But as a fifth form at school, when I should have been concentrating on my O levels, another indication of how long ago this was, I backed Troy for the Derby and tipped him to anybody who was interested in listening, including my dad and his neighbour, who lumped on, probably had £1 each way or something like that. Troy won the Derby, one of the best Derbies ever, actually, and one of the best Derby winners ever, in my view. And I managed to follow it up, and this really is after timing, with the winner of the Oaks at something like 20-1 a few days later as well. So I do wonder what might have happened if my first couple of bets hadn't been spectacularly successful. I think there's a degree of sort of survivorship bias with people in horse racing. You know, if you had one of those 15-runner losing sequences as your first 15 bets, you might have walked away. But I think I was far too hooked anyway. Lulled me into the false sense that it might be actually something I could make money out of. But I've been trying ever since.
Wonderful. I think we've all got a bit of that survivorship bias, certainly. Speaking of getting into racing through that particular route, many of us, of course, have our traditional racing heroes growing up, be they jockeys or trainers. I'm interested in who yours were, because you grew up in an era of some really remarkable racing performances.
Yeah. On the race course, I think Steve Cawthon, as a jockey in particular, absolutely brilliant at his best. I think he was the best jockey I've ever seen. He was a magnificent judge of pace, brilliant, brilliant rider. But he crossed over with the tail end of Lester Piggott as well. And so what a remarkable era that was. And we've had some good jockeys since, some very, very good jockeys, and do at present. But Piggott against Cawthon in the mid to late 80s was something else. So him, perhaps most on course. Off course, though, was the founder of Timeform, which is Phil Bull, who was not only a great punter, a good mathematician, somebody who dealt with figures, and somebody who created a lasting legacy by establishing Timeform as a analytical way of looking at horse racing, and did an awful lot of good, I think, as a result. He was a man with trenchant views about racing politics and about life more widely, and I think that's to be admired. We can all become a little bit tunnel visioned in our approach to life when we're obsessed with horse racing, and he managed to keep his eye on quite a lot of other things as well. And so he was probably my, not only my main hero, but also, whether he knew it or not, perhaps my greatest influence. He and I crossed over at Timeform by a couple of years. I didn't see an awful lot of him, but I did have one or two memorable days at the races in his company, and also at his castle on the outskirts of Halifax. A remarkable man, I think.
Absolutely, and I think that is a very good note upon which to end part one of this edition of Betting People. Welcome back to Betting People with Simon Rowlands. Having talked about how you got into racing, Simon, we're now going to talk about how you got into, well, I think you've really turned into a bit of a science here, which is sectionals and race reading through the lens of the clock. So first of all, how did sectionals really stand out to you?
I've got to admit, I was a fairly late adopter, as these things go. It might seem a bit strange now, but by late adopter, I mean in the 1990s, late 1990s, really. So after my education in teaching myself about racing, I did end up at Timeform, which was a dream job. Started there in the mid-80s. And was very soon as a handicapper. And in a large way, I regard myself as a handicapper, a form handicapper, a ratings person first and foremost. Back in those days, you could do pretty well just by assessing the form better than other people. And I found I was quite good at that, and I was very happy doing that. But things became more difficult. Things became more competitive. The public in general became more clued up, I think, from the 90s onwards, as we got pictures in transmitted into homes in a way that hadn't been the case before. And taking a result as read, that horse A beat horse B, and all you had to do was assess what that meant comparative to other races wasn't sufficient quite soon. And it took me a few years, but things like reinterpreting results through understanding how horses had got from A to B in terms of energy distribution and everything is best measured through sectionals and is crucial. An understanding of pace tells you whether the race in question has suited horses close up or held up, horses with stamina or with speed. And as racing has got more and more competitive, it's those little nuances that make the difference between winning and losing. So I started looking into sectionals late 90s. Certainly by the early 2000s, I was all over them, really. Back then, you primarily had to take your own from videos. And I didn't have video editing software or anything like that to help. And so it was stopwatch and video VHS or even Betamax, rewind and do it often enough to get it right. But it was good enough to give me a bit of an advantage. I primarily punted for a living in the early days of Betfair, 2003 to middle of 2005, and an insight into racing that other people weren't using all that much in terms of sectionals was very useful. More recently, we've had sectionals put on a plate for us a bit more, thanks to Total Performance Data in particular. A lot of their work is can be seen on at the races, and I've become one of the people who's written about those sectionals, try to give an overall context of what we're looking for with sectional timing. So I wrote an introduction to sectional timing for Timeform 5 or 6 years ago. And then on a more regular basis, a sectional spotlight for at the races. And also through my own tipping and my own betting sectionals. I wouldn't say they're a major part of what I do, but they can bring huge value to bets and selections. So that's how I've got where I am now.
It's interesting you say they wouldn't say you're a major part of what you do. Is it, are they all individual toolkits that you use to read a race, or is there another factor that you find particularly important?
I think that's the thing, is that you should never lose sight of the fact that analysing racing is a multi-disciplined task, and you can get somewhere by focusing only on, say, the draw or trainer form or whatever, or sectionals for that matter. You occasionally come across some real nuggets with sectionals, but if I'm looking at, I don't know, 10 races on a day and I have half a dozen bets, maybe only one or two of those are prompted directly by sectionals. All the other things, form ratings, draw, trainer form, pace analysis, etc. All those things go into the mix. I look at everything through a prism of sectionals, but ultimately there aren't enough edges all the time for me to bet entirely around sectionals alone. You have to bring in lots of other things and ultimately work towards trying to price races up better than the bookmakers do and the general public does. And that requires that you take into account as much information as possible, not just sectionals alone. But every time I look at a race, I want to know what the sectionals tell me about the general context of that race.
And you use that to inform your punting when you were on Betfair in the early days. Is there anything, obviously with the big benefits of hindsight here, but is there anything you'd go back and you do differently now if you were restarting sort of at that period?
Good question. Andrew Black, one of the founders of Betfair, once said to me, the key to good betting, and he's done pretty well himself, is getting the right balance between fear and greed. And I'm quite risk averse, and I have perhaps a bit too much fear and I'm a bit too cautious at times. I had an advantage back then, and I wish I'd pressed it more than I did. But the advantage began to erode around about 2005, and other opportunities came up for me as well. I've, despite being somebody who writes quite a lot of sort of algorithms and around automated processes, I'm not very capable in that area myself, and I wish I'd learned more about automating the placement of bets and things like that. It was still quite labor intensive and hands on, and that's still the case nowadays. And I really benefited from perhaps knowing a bit more technical stuff so that I could have scaled up my operation a little bit. But no regrets, really. It was 2 or 3 years which were really good fun, flying by the seats of my pants at times. And I'm really glad I did it. But ultimately, working on your own, betting on your own, can be a little bit soul-destroying. I know people who have been doing this for 10, 15, 20 years. It's difficult to get the life-work balance correct. I think I managed it, but it was only just. And other opportunities came along, and I've always wanted to sort of share my views with other people. Other people haven't always wanted me to share my views with them, but what I wanted most from a life in horse racing was to be a good journalist and a good handicapper and a good analyst, rather than just making lots and lots of cash for myself, if only.
It's interesting, actually, just something to pick on. When you talk about the algorithms and the processes, there are quite a few pieces of software now that will automate your betting, your feed to some extent. I've heard of them. What exactly does that software do? And is it the case that it's still very labor intensive, or is it now something that can be done by a robot or the computer itself?
Well, I may be the wrong person to ask this, because I haven't really embraced it. Even back in 2002, people had robotic software, and I know that that's the case very widely now, really. Things like bet placement, through particularly for in-running betting, exists. I did briefly look into it. My betting nowadays is not so... So back then, I was turning over quite a fair bit of money on 30 or 40 races a week. Nowadays, there'd be more like, you know, half a dozen races a week, and it's quite easy for me to handle that manually. The bots have inherited the world in some areas. They never sleep. I was going to say they never make mistakes. I'm sure they do, or the humans who... who write them do, and they sometimes switch themselves off and things like that. But the best punters I've ever met are the people who still do it kind of the old-fashioned way. They might not have the scale of robotic software, but they still can spot an opportunity and have a decent bet on individual opportunities. And I'm glad of that, really, because I think we could be working in a sort of a almost like a stock exchange atmosphere in which your bot plays against my bot. And that's not the case. And there's still a lot of scope for people to express themselves, I suppose, through betting, and educate themselves in areas, specialize so that they can be better than the opposition in particular areas. And long may that continue, I reckon.
Well said. I'm sure many will agree with you. That's a perfect way to end part two. Welcome back to part three of Betting People with Simon Rowlands. We've talked about how you got into racing. We've also talked about how you started betting, how you started using sectionals. You've also written an awful lot, and that's how many of our viewers would come to know you. So let's go right back to when you were at The Sportsman, when you were actually racing editor. Tell us how you got that break.
Yeah, I mentioned in the previous piece about how I was punting, and punting was becoming more difficult and less fulfilling as much as anything. And I got contacted through social media, actually, or as a result of a forum, not the Betfair forum, which I steer well clear of these days, by somebody looking to start a rival to the Racing Post primarily, but with an emphasis on wider sport and not just horse racing. So I was interested. As I mentioned, my ambition in life really was to be a good racing journalist and a good racing analyst. So this was a great opportunity. There didn't seem to be much opportunity at the Racing Post itself for what it's worth back then. And so I met up with the people behind the Sportsman. By the people, I mean, actually, there were only two or three of them at that stage, a year before the paper was launched. I was involved in recruiting people. And I discovered that quite a lot of people were good at saying where the Racing Post was going wrong and how they could do a better job, but not necessarily that many people would put themselves forward and take the risk of actually trying to achieve that. So it was quite a job to try and get people on board to what was, a fledgling, promising operation, but one that obviously had some risks attached. A few of my colleagues from Timeform joined, which is great. They were all really good operators. And it looked for a while like it might succeed. But there's an awful lot of difficulty in bringing something like that to fruition. Doesn't surprise me. And instead of launching in the middle of February 2006, we had to delay it. Now, the reality is, I think it should have been delayed a bit longer and we would have hit the ground running, but we kind of fell between two stools in the end, in that we launched in March of 2006 with something that was getting pretty close to getting there, but which wasn't really quite, it was pretty rough around the edges. Nonetheless, it, after some very public teething problems in the first month or two, kind of got quite a bit of support and was heading in the right direction when the money ran out, or the people who put up money in the first place decided that they weren't going to throw good money after bad, in their view, and they may have been right. And so the plug was pulled in October 2006. Huge shame, one of the biggest disappointments of my life. There were so many talented people involved who put an awful lot into it and took big risks, and that's from right at the top all the way down to the people that I brought on board as well. I'm glad to say a lot of them seem to have done pretty well since, though. October 2006, I found myself out of a job, but funnily enough, the Sportsman's offices were bang next door to Betfair on the Hammersmith waterfront. And I knew a few people from Betfair from my early days of betting. And they were in touch with me pretty quickly to see if I was interested in a new project they had, which they wouldn't tell me what it was, unfortunately. But finding myself out of a job, I obviously said yes. I was living in London. It was... I didn't exactly have money to burn, and I did go 3 months of being unemployed and not being able to draw any wages or benefits or anything. What it transpired to be was a Betfair radio, internet radio, which soon, around about the time I moved on, turned into Timeform Radio. So I was involved in starting Betfair Radio in January, February of 2007. Along with one other guy who walked out 2 weeks before the thing was going to launch, which left me having to do everything, literally everything, including punditing and presenting and turning the lights off at the end of the day at times. It had a very small budget back in those days. Wasn't my favourite job ever, we could say, but got involved again with some really good people, including David Stewart of Star Sports these days, who was one of the people who carried it on after I decided I had enough in June of 2007. I'm kind of really proud of what Timeform Radio became. Unfortunately, it's RIP these days. It lasted several years, but then somebody else pulled the plug on that. But I wasn't the right person to be heading it up. At least I got it underway.
Indeed, many fond memories, actually, I'm sure, for people watching this from the early days of the internet radio, tidal radio, or both radio, whatever you call it, especially actually given that it quickly became probably my favourite radio station during college days. So I'm sure many people would have enjoyed hearing about that. You then went back freelancing, as I understand it, after then. Were you happy with that move at the time? Do you think it worked out?
Well, I realised how much I missed just basically analysing racing properly in a time form sort of way, looking at racing, putting ratings on racing, giving race reading commentaries on what's gone on and interpretations. And freelancing involved working for Timeform, establishing a Timeform Ireland service, as well as some, I appeared on telly a few times, not particularly gloriously. I don't think I'm a natural broadcaster, but Timeform was the main focus of what I was doing. And I'm very grateful to people like Mark Davis and Andrew Black at Betfair, who helped smooth my passage back to Timeform, and for me to be involved there. I mixed between being freelance and being on staff actually over the next sort of 10 odd years before going entirely freelance and Timeform ceasing to be quite such a big part of my working life actually from the beginning of 2016 onwards. But it was great to be back involved with Timeform at a time when they were looking into things like automations, which I'm interested in, intrigued in, intellectually invested in, and also moving into new territories like Timeform US, which I helped to establish, and Timeform Ireland, which no longer exists specifically. But yeah, those about 8 or 9 years were good. And it also meant I moved away from London. I love London. I love living in London, but it's pretty expensive. And I moved back up north, not all the way back up north, but to near Sheffield.
Oh, absolutely. And with that, moving to freelance and being able to analyse racing again, do you feel that the quality of your work improved for that? Sort of maybe not being released from the shackles, but maybe sort of being a bit freer, as it has done for some people who I know have taken that path from racing, whether it was to punt or to write or to analyse in your case.
Yeah. I got to indulge myself a little bit. And I thank Timeform for that. I mean, there was a lot of grunting doing stuff like automations and everything, but yeah, I think it meant that I was able to look into things like sectionals and automated handicapping and the way of race reading and everything in a depth I wouldn't have been able to have done if I was trying to, you know, turn a living out of doing this, that and the other. And so I did get to look into stuff in more detail, and thanks to Timeform, I'm not sure other countries and other times there's been that kind of opportunity. It's a fantastic place to be involved with. But we have sort of gone our separate ways, although I write the odd article for them still, and I'm still massively interested in what they have to say about the racing scene.
Hello and welcome to the fourth and final part of Betting People with Simon Rowland. Now, Simon, we've talked about a whole host of your methods and your experiences within racing, but one thing you've been working on recently, which has attracted an awful lot of positive attention, is a fascinating new way to measure horses, or at least something that is now much widespread, which is striding data. Now, first of all, tell us basically what exactly striding data is that you're measuring and what it can tell your average race fan about a horse.
Yeah, the two main components of a horse getting from A to B fast, the speed it travels, is how long its stride is and how frequently it turns that stride over. It's just that simple. If you can figure out how frequently a horse strides, you can, and how quickly it was running, you can also back engineer how long its stride was. Now, new technology, total performance data, uses something which can record that stride frequency. It's not unlike, as I understand it, what you would have in a Fitbit, which records how many strides you take a day. Mine has gone up in lockdown, I'm glad to say, somewhat ironically, walking round and round a room. And the stride length of the horse is correlated with its ability, but is also very heavily affected by things like the speed of the surface, whether it's going uphill or downhill or round a bend. And so it's quite difficult to isolate the information from that. But the other aspect, the frequency of its striding, or what is known as cadence, is very easy to isolate and isn't really affected by that much by extraneous factors like that. And from that, you can tell quite a lot about the likelihood of a horse staying or not. Sprinters have to be able to stride quickly, otherwise they wouldn't be able to run quickly enough as sprinters. Stayers have to be able to do the opposite, and actually stride quite slowly, otherwise they expend too much energy along the way. The best horses do a bit of both. Winks could sprint like a sprinter and switch off like a middle distance horse. Stradivarius is a horse who can sprint really good for really well for a furlong or two by increasing his cadence, but basically switches off for a lot of his race, as all good stayers do. Now, that isn't an awful lot of use when you're dealing with a bunch of exposed mile handicappers, where you pretty much know what they do anyway, although you can get the occasional insight. But it's particularly useful with things like Classic Hopes at this kind of time of year. And so a year ago, Too Darn Hot was quite a short price favourite for the Derby. And and in terms of his breeding, there were good reason to think he might be a Derby horse, but in terms of his striding, there was no way he was likely to be a Derby horse. He strode like a 7-furlong, 8-furlong performer. He nearly won the Dante, seemed to empty out towards the end, was returned to 7 furlongs and a mile and confirmed himself as a top notcher. Now, that's one that worked out well. Some of them don't work out so well, but the point, as in all horse racing analysis, is to tip the odds in your favour. And if you're selective and if you're able to do the homework, you can get some good insights, with particularly in terms of a horse's likely stamina. I mentioned that Total Performance Data puts this on a plate for you. It appears in the results section of At the Races, but you can also do this by using advanced video editing technology, slow the pictures down, counting strides, understanding sectionals, and get the same sort of results. And you're likely to find that nobody else is looking at that particular horse in the same sort of way. So needless to say, occasionally you can have insights that are really pretty valuable.
Thank you very much for a very comprehensive explanation there. Now, the fact that actually we've got that sort of data accessible shows that racing has come a fair way in terms of, you know, making things more accessible for not only the average fan, but also somebody who'd want to take things more seriously. What further steps can the sport take basically to allow people to analyse it as closely as you can do with cricket or football or golf, etc.?
Yeah, I think even before we take further steps or go into further data, which I will move on to, I think explaining this to the public more widely is a challenge. I try. I would welcome it if more of the media outlets, both printed and broadcast, tried a bit harder also in getting the basic concepts of things like sectionals and striding across to people. Obviously, it can appear very complex and a bit daunting, but, you know, the challenge is to show people that there's something there, that it's not just a load of numbers, that it can actually really not only give you insights, but enhance your enjoyment of the experience. And so I would hope that will happen. In terms of other sort of data points, I'd like to see the idea of horse weights explored. I've recommended, including to the BHA and others, that there's a pilot project. So why not, you know, British Champions Day or something like that? We weigh all the horses. We find out the logistical problems. At some point in the future, you might say we can't really do this, or it's the expenditure is not justified, but at least give it a go. I wrote something a good few years ago when Abel Friend came across to Ascot and pointed out what a huge horse he was and how he strode and things like that, and put it up as a sort of a tale of the tape, like a boxing match between him and Solo, the French horse. And Abel Friend was an absolutely monstrously big horse. And I think that's interesting. Even if it doesn't change the way you bet or your overall appreciation of racing, to know that basically this is David against Goliath, I think enhances your enjoyment. And so British Champions Day or an all-weather track during the winter or something like that, find out how it's possible to get that data. What I would be convinced of is that you, and not just, I've done some research into horse weights in Hong Kong in the past, that you can get some usefulness, utility out of horse weights. Recently, you had there was an interview on Sky Sports Racing with Roger Charlton, where he was talking about Quadrilateral, his favourite for the 1,000 guineas, and he went into great detail about what the horse's weight was and how she'd been 530 kilograms over the winter, was now down to, I think, 510, and that he was aiming for about 485 for her to be at her peak fighting weight, as it were. I think that's fascinating. And I'd love, it would make me much more engaged with the sport if I could see those ebbs and flows and fluctuations along the way. So I'd like to see that happen anyway.
Absolutely, and I certainly agree with all of that. And I believe in Hong Kong, and to a lesser extent, the US, that sort of data, weight race data, is pretty routinely used already, especially, I mean, it's used all across the board in Hong Kong, but especially when it does come to elite level racing, it's often used actually for punting purposes. So no, I completely agree with that. Going forward, obviously racing is at a real crossroads. Assuming that the sport could come back and come to something like its former position, what change would you like to make to the sport as a whole, if you could, putting you in charge of racing here, I realise, but or something I do like to ask the interviewees?
If I was a benign dictator, or even a malign dictator, I'm not sure which. there's a few people who I'd send packing, I must admit, but I won't name names here. I think one consequence of recent events is that, whether we like it or not, there's going to have to be a bit of pruning. I think that's sad, and people are going to suffer as a result of that, race courses maybe, and owners and the like. But the fixture list has seemed rather obese in recent years. It's pretty much impossible for the dedicated racing enthusiast to follow all of the action, particularly during the summer. And rather than hold our heads in alarm, I think we possibly should embrace a bit of a reduction in the fixture list. I think it could ultimately be for the benefit of racing. More focus, less flab. That sounds almost like a mantra for me, actually.
We're all stuck inside. It's absolutely fine to respond to however you want.
Amongst other things I wouldn't mind seeing is, something I proposed about 10 years ago, a thing a little bit like the racemakers concept. I was involved in that briefly. I didn't follow it through, but I did do a day at the St. Ledger meeting, in which racing enthusiasts go out and you know, and make themselves available to the public to explain what's going on. I'd like to see that to be more of an industry-wide initiative, and particularly licensed individuals would understand that once in a while, and it really would be fairly infrequently, they'd be expected to sort of step up and inform and educate the public and answer questions before race meetings and after race meetings. By licensed personnel, I mean people like media, people like me, as well as trainers and jockeys and even owners and stable staff and the like. To give the public, so when you go to Kempton and there's only a few hundred people there and the racing's quite boring, you at least got to hear Roger Charlton do 10 minutes on how he's getting quadrilateral fit for the Guineas or something like that. It would get me to go racing. It would get me more interested in the sport. And I think it's one where everybody in the sport can make a contribution, really. So that might be something to explore. I would give less power to these some of the stakeholders within horse racing. I think it's absolutely crucial that you canvass the opinions of race courses and trainers and jockeys and the like, and that you incorporate that in decisions. But got a danger of, particularly recently, of backseat drivers taking over in horse racing. Ultimately, the people who run the sport should be informed by those people and by people like the Horse Racing Betters Forum, but not dictated to by them. And I would change the dynamic there, which is a lot easier said than done, but you did give me the authority to change anything I wanted.
I give everybody who asks that question the authority to change anything they want to in racing. What's next for you now? Because you're still writing all these great pieces, and I do heartily recommend, after watching this, that you go and check out Simon's pieces on race reading for At the Races. And you've got bits and pieces elsewhere. What's in the future for Simon Rowland?
I wouldn't want anybody to get the impression that I'm fully employed at present. I'm earning about 20% of what I was before, and I don't get any payment from the government, or unless I were to pretty much have no work, in which case I can consider that. So it's coming at a cost to me, but I'm keeping my eye in. As it happens, I've got quite a lot of family sort of stuff that means that I probably couldn't be working flat out at the moment anyway. One of the things that I was doing prior to that all happening was establishing a website for my company, Rowlands Racing Research Limited, mostly as a way of just displaying my work, as it were, links to my work, but also there would have been a few commentaries on current developments and some more details, things like standard times that I've calculated that I'd like to share more widely. That's been put on the back burner for a while, but I'm still hoping it might be out possibly before the end of May. We shall see, but that depends really on quite a lot of things, not least whether suddenly racing does return.
Indeed, and I think that's a really good note upon which to end. Well, it's been a fascinating and really informative betting people. Thank you so much for your time, Simon.
And you, William.
All the best to you in the future, and thank you very much for watching.
Starsports.bet provide the complete betting experience. Find us online via our website and app, on course, and at our flagship betting shop in London's Mayfair. 18 years and older only. BeGambleAware.org.